How has the investment landscape changed since we launched Global Equity ESG 6 years ago? We find out next. Welcome to Amplified, the Hermes podcast channel, where we discuss the key issues, challenges, and trends shaping the investment landscape. I'm Tara Cunningham, Senior Manager of Content at the firm. Today, we're celebrating. Our Global Equity ESG capability marks its 6-year anniversary this month. And so, we're doing something a little different. Instead of bringing the team to the studio, we're joining Lewis Grant, Senior Portfolio Manager, and Louise Dudley, Portfolio Manager, during one of their weekly catch-ups back at our head office, as they look back on 6 years of Global Equity ESG.
Louise, when we launched our Global Equity ESG capability back in May 2013, I think the world was a very different place, and I think sustainability was still very niche. I think that's clearly no longer the case, but what do you think have been the main developments in that time?
So there are a whole range of things that have happened. I think we've seen a real development in the demand. So underlying, a lot of the clients have established policies around incorporating ESG information into how they assess strategies and how they think about their views and their investments long term. We've also seen a number of directives come into play in Europe, in the US, and across the world, which have helped companies to articulate what they're doing and put in some minimum standards. Alongside that, we've also had stock exchanges also coming on board, developing processes and kind of more regulatory burdens, which have really helped. We've also seen, from the financial perspective, a number of corporate governance codes and stewardship codes, which have really helped to push the agenda within the financial sector. Alongside that, there's also the principles of responsible investment organisation, who have continued to garner a number of signatures. And so now, in terms of the amount of assets that are covered by those principles is now greater than those that are not covered. And so certainly for the clients that we're working with, they really feel that being a signatory to the principles for responsible investment is a minimum standard. And so therefore, anyone who isn't fulfilling those and who isn't really continuing to improve their process in terms of how they integrate ESG has really kind of fallen behind. But, you know, we have seen a real widespread and rapid adoption of ESG analysis across the whole range of industry.
It's been quite incredible, actually. I think if you think back to when we started, there was just a handful of providers of ESG information. And when we were looking around for data for a number of years before we could do this credibly, but there's been an almost explosion in the number of ESG data providers now. And we had that belief early on that we shouldn't follow a single ratings provider to tell us how good a company was from an environmental, social or governance perspective, but that we should build our own way of thinking about this. But as so many people have got interested in this, so many people are trying to have that opinion and give the data to the different firms to allow them to integrate ESG. For us, we've always looked to take that data from multiple sources, recognising that no one has all of the answers. And I think perhaps most crucially, we found over the last few years that actually that data from our own engagement team is the most insightful, the most timely, and the most enlightening when you're trying to identify change in companies. And I think that the fundamental problem we had back then remains is that companies haven't been giving enough information, or where companies have been disclosing, it's not been standardized. And that's been a real challenge. And yet it's not stopped these data providers from taking the same data but finding new ways to slice it and to present it, to bring in, you know, big data and artificial intelligence and neural networks. It's somewhat hard to separate the signal from the noise, from the, well, frankly, marketing spin. And I don't want to sound too kind of skeptical or cynical about the whole thing, But it is a difficulty to recognise who's actually doing this and who's just talking about it. There's been a huge increase in data quantity. I'm not convinced we've seen an increase in data quality over the last few years. It's confirmed that our original belief was right, that you need to look at multiple data sources, but we've always had that challenge of how do you integrate that and how do you develop the process to reflect this new information.
And I think in terms of our own methodology, we've seen a big development over the years since 2014. So specifically, you know, the enhancements that we've made over the years. Originally, our dashboard was created in 2010. Following on from that, we then created the QESG score in 2013, which was really the first time when we'd decided we had sufficient information to quantitatively assess companies. And just because at that point, the data availability was so much broader. Following on from that, enhancing the dashboard in 2016, and then again in 2017. But with each incremental improvement, I think we've brought in those new data sources and been able to capture the improved data quality. The underlying methodology hasn't changed, so we're still looking at identifying or trying to split out the companies in terms of whether they're best in class, average or poor. And then using a range of the data providers, as you mentioned, to ensure that the way how we're assessing companies is slightly more robust, incorporating the in-house information that we have from EOS. But really having that underlying governance focus, I think, has been quite key. The developments that we've seen, particularly one of the newer data sources that we have, is incorporating information on the Sustainable Development Goals. So to a certain extent, taking our focus a little bit less on the risk and backward-looking information, but more forward-looking analysis and looking at where companies are going, particularly those companies that are better positioned to transition within this evolving world that we have and increased regulation from an ESG perspective.
It seems quite incredible if you go back and look at that first ESG dashboard that we built back in 2010, how much it has evolved, both from a presentational perspective, but also the data on there now is incomparable. The philosophy is the same,
yeah.
But things like that SDG information looking forward is just something that just wasn't available all those years ago.
Yeah, and it's still a challenge to capture the latest information and to try and put a systematic framework around it. But I think us doing it back in 2010 and then evolving it over time, recognising that when we first did it, it wasn't going to be perfect, but we've been able to continually improve it, has meant that we've been able to keep at the forefront of integrating ESG and the latest information.
In the past 20 years, the number of asset managers offering ESG has grown by more than 400%. But what caused this surge in ESG investing? Well, the UN Global Compact published a report called Who Cares Wins in 2005. And its findings had a big impact on the investment industry. It found that integrating ESG into capital markets resulted in more sustainable markets and better outcomes for society too. At the same time, the UNEP Finance Initiative released a report that showed ESG issues are relevant for financial valuation. Together, these two reports laid the foundation for the launch of the Principles of Responsible Investment in 2006. And as Louise said, we became a founding signatory. That was 13 years ago. Today, the PRI is an established body, representing over $70 trillion assets under management. Governments and regulators are demanding that companies and their owners consider the wider ESG implications of their business activities by introducing or strengthening stewardship codes. Let's take, for example, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. They were established in 2015 to serve as a blueprint for significantly changing the world by 2030. In the same year, 195 countries adopted the first ever universal, legally binding global climate deal, the Paris Agreement. And there is a growing body of research supporting the integration of ESG too, our own included. Let's pick up again with the Lewis and Louise, where they're discussing trends in research. In particular, our paper, ESG Investing, A Social Uprising, which was published in November last year. And it was also cited by Bank of England Governor Mark Carney when he addressed the European Commission Conference on a Global Approach to Sustainable Finance in March.
When we first wrote our ESG Investing paper back in 2013, I had fairly low expectations. I believed that ESG mattered, but I didn't honestly believe we'd be able to show it. And so it was very pleasing to find that there wasn't a link between the environmental scores and the social scores and shareholder returns, i.e. we could actually show that companies that were better managing their environmental and social risks weren't underperforming. But even better and even more unexpectedly, we could show a statistically significant link between corporate governance and shareholder returns. We could show that the companies that were getting this wrong actually underperformed. And it was fantastic to be able to show this because it really helped to convince many of the skeptics that ESG is more than just a nice to have, that it can actually help people to maximise their returns. And one of the more interesting results in there that got a lot of attention was that the hyper-growth companies, the companies that were essentially delivering the disruptive change, actually governance perhaps wasn't quite as important for those companies. Perhaps it wasn't quite as accurate a predictor of future performance. And that's been a very important message to recognise where governance perhaps hasn't been as important when we've seen such narrow markets dominated by these disruptive technology companies as we have done for the last few years. But even so, in our latest research, we've been able to show that elsewhere, governance still matters. But even more positively, in that latest paper, we've been able to show that the social behaviour of companies matters. Now, so far, this is only for companies outside of North America, but we've actually shown a statistically significant link between the social scores we're giving to companies and shareholder returns, such that the companies that get it wrong have actually tended to underperform. And again, that's a fantastic way of confirming our initial beliefs and helping to convince investors and asset owners that ESG investing is consistent with maximising returns.
Yeah, and that's a really significant result. I think, you know, having the evidence behind the ESG factors is something that we often get asked about. And particularly on the social side, where we've started to see it really making a difference and we have the evidence behind it, really makes sense when you look at the underlying belief in terms of social factors having a greater importance, both for companies and more widely within society. Recognising that a business's social impact, how they treat their employees, how they treat their customers, how they think about their supply chain, are key drivers of both returns, but also in terms of revenues and brand value, that we can see that starting to come through in the numbers, which is a really exciting result that we've seen. One of the other key things in terms of the significance of that investing paper and how really it was differentiated from some of the other results that we've seen, we have obviously seen a number of academic results that have come out which have been quite aligned to what we found. But I think for us, we had that real focus on returns and linking ESG to those positive outcomes. And I think having that real granular approach in terms of specifically looking at where factors were material and not being so broad in our approach, actually being quite specific about what we were looking for has helped to deliver that outperformance. I think also recognising the limitations of the data as well, where sometimes some of the information that we're using we know isn't of the highest quality. And so therefore applying a more qualitative lens to some of the issues has also helped to contribute to the kind of the positive results that we've seen. Definitely our experience, particularly the EOS team, which has been going now for over 15 years, their experience and the kind of volume of companies that they're talking to on an annual basis in terms of specifically those governance conversations that they're having and how that gets applied into our underlying thinking of how we think about some of these factors has really added to the outperformance of some of the results, but also how we apply it in terms of some of the capabilities that we have.
I think it comes down to knowing the limitations of the data, as you say. It's about understanding where the data can be used and where it can't perhaps be used, and being a little bit more intelligent about what you do with the numbers that you're getting from all of these different sources. And that's where the expertise of that engagement work is so valuable to us, is realizing this data can be incredibly useful if you use it intelligently. And also then having clear objectives of what you're trying to achieve. As you say, we focus very much on, can we use this to find better companies and better long-term investments? And that's important that we can demonstrate the value of that when we're trying to encourage asset owners to invest sustainably. But they're also thinking about their fiduciary duty and whether they have a requirement to think more broadly about the impact they're having on the world. So not just perhaps from a returns perspective, but actually what is the outcomes of the investments that they're actually making. And so it's thinking about it from a returns perspective has been very important, but increasingly people are also thinking about what else are the investments actually doing.
Yeah, and that really ties into the underlying theme of fiduciary duty and how we've seen that evolve over the last couple of years, particularly one of the reports that we've actually seen come out recently from an organisation called the Network for Greening the Financial System, which is really a collaborative organisation which has now grown to 34 members made up of central banks and supervisors. So really the people who are at the top end of the financial food chain, that they've started to articulate how some climate-related financial risk should be taken into account. So specifically looking at scenario testing, thinking about a green terminology, a framework, such that the different players within the market can articulate what is green, what is brown. And having those frameworks allows for the development of whether it's products or whether it's the companies themselves, in terms of meeting those underlying criteria, can be quite beneficial. And this latest report that's just come out really takes it to the next stage in terms of those recommendations. And I think that's something that we can talk to our wider clients about in terms of how they're thinking about climate-related financial risks, going to the next stage of mapping both the physical and the transition risks, and how that makes a difference both from a company perspective and also within a portfolio context as well. So as well as that, it's going to start to improve and share the knowledge that's been built up over the last couple of years across the world, but also will start to lead to changes, and specifically kind of feeding on from a lot of the engagement and advocacy that we do around climate change, really starting to see how that can materialise and start to lead to real differences within the environment that we're working in.
And it's great because we see now the pressure that's coming from almost the other end of the chain, when you've got the millennials showing increasing interest, you've got the school protests, the protests across London and the rest of the world. You know, people on the street care about this, but also we're getting the support, as you say, at the other end from the top down. So there's really increasing focus and increasing resources and reason to do this, which is a great message and is actually feeding through to the asset owners who generally want to do this, they just haven't always known how to invest sustainably.
That was Lewis Grant, Senior Portfolio Manager, ending that discussion with Louise Dudley, Portfolio Manager. 6 years. It's a long time in the world of investing. And as Louise and Lewis have rightly pointed out, much has changed. And some of these developments have positively contributed to global equity ESG. As ever, feel free to get in touch if you have any feedback about this episode of Amplified, or if there's any burning themes that you'd like us to cover in the future. Until next time, I'm Tara Cunningham, Senior Manager of Content at Hermes. Thank you for listening to Amplified.
Thank you for listening to the Hermes podcast. If you found it interesting and would like to listen to more podcasts by Hermes, please visit our website, hermes-investment.com, and search for podcasts. These podcasts are for information purposes only, and the views, information, or opinions expressed therein are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Hermes Investment Management and its employees. Performance should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All the performance represented is historical. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results, and investors may not recover the full amount invested.